Lots of response about how to sign off emails. Jennifer says, I don't like cheers as I associate it with drinking and alcohol. So that's a fair point. And this is a good question because I think people often don't know. What does ngā mihi mean? You know, what does it actually mean when you sign that off?
Like kind regards, it is kind of regards. Thank you very much.
Is it an acknowledgement?
Yeah.
It's just an acknowledgement that you've...
Ngā mihi nui is thank you very much. Yeah, because sort of, yeah. Thanks for your time.
Ruwani Pereira and Steve McCabe on the panel. It's 26 minutes to 5. And the government's been criticised for the imbalance in the way wage subsidy fraud is dealt with compared to benefit fraud. Writing for Stuff, researcher Max Rashbrook says that not only is the COVID-19 wage subsidy much easier to access than the unemployment benefit, but not enough scrutiny has been applied to firms who are using it. And Max joins us now. Kia ora, Max.
Got it.
As your piece states, it's much easier for people to apply for the wage subsidy than the unemployment benefit?
Yeah, I mean, the contrast is really stark. I mean, as you'll have seen, I start off the piece with a quote from an RNZ journalist, in fact, who's saying, you know, that business groups are telling their members, look, just get your application in and, quote, worry about the details later. Now, I mean, anyone who's ever had to deal with the benefit system will tell you that that's not how it works. I mean, you have to provide the most colossal amount of documentation, which, you know, reasonably often Work and Income then loses, so you have to try to resupply it if you can. There's huge hoops. The calculations about what you're entitled to run for pages and pages and pages. We treat those two groups of people completely differently.
You do acknowledge, though, that the wage subsidy, it was put together quickly. What do you think needs to change?
Yeah, look, and I think anyone sensible absolutely acknowledges that it had to operate very quickly initially, and it had to be high trust, you know, because you had to get money out the door quickly. That's absolutely fine. But, you know, there was an Auditor General report into the scheme. And what they pointed out is that the looser you are, the more trusting you are up front, the harsher you have to be in terms of checking people's payments after the fact to make sure that they were actually entitled to them. And that really didn't happen initially. You know, MSD didn't do much more than just ring people up and sort of say, oh, you know, I mean, was that true? You know, that application you put in, and business would say, oh, well, yes, it is. And then MSD would say, oh, well, great, we've audited them. And of course, that's not an audit. Now, MSD are tightening up, you know, after that Auditor General's rebuke. You have to give them some credit. Things are getting a bit tighter, but they're still nowhere near tight enough. There's only 8 prosecutions so far against firms for defrauding the wage subsidy. And when you think about $13 billion was given out, do we really think that's the entirety of the fraud that was perpetrated? It seems very unlikely.
You think that there's way more businesses ripping them off?
I just think it would be extremely unlikely given how strongly the economy rebounded. I mean, if the New Zealand economy had tanked, then you would think, well, yeah, probably most of that $13 billion went to businesses that genuinely saw a revenue decline of 30% during lockdown. But businesses rebounded so strongly, you know, cash reserves amongst New Zealand businesses are really strong. The GST payments have been very high. I just am sceptical that all the businesses that applied for it were actually eligible in terms of having experienced that revenue drop.
You can go online and see who has applied for it. That's one thing, I guess. If you want to know if your company has, you can go and see if they have and how much money they've got.
Yeah, you can for a lot of businesses, but not for all of them. I mean, for privacy reasons, MSD didn't publish the names of sole traders or firms, I think, that employed fewer than 3 staff. And, of course, in New Zealand, that's a lot of people. So, actually, the transparency on the wage subsidy is good, but it's far from perfect.
So your article, you've also tied it to historical research showing the difference between jail time that's given to people who commit benefit fraud compared to white-collar criminals.
Yeah, and this is something that I find, I don't use this word lightly, I genuinely find this repugnant. Research that my colleague at Vic, Lisa Marriott, did showed that, you know, sort of tax fraud, white-collar fraud, you know, on average is sort of 4 or 5 times worse than benefit fraud, but people who commit tax fraud are much less likely to go to prison. And what's even worse is that when you look at the judgments, which Dr. Marriott has done, you know, the court judgments about tax fraudsters are full of language about, you know, the wonderful service that they provided to the community before their offending and sort of what great character they've otherwise demonstrated. And whereas the judgments on beneficiaries who've committed benefit fraud, you know, absolutely slate them and, you know, and sort of tear their character to bits. And it's a really profound example of, you know, of class prejudice, you know, operating in what is supposed to be one of the most neutral bits of the New Zealand, New Zealand public life.
Well, thanks, Max. Stay with us. I just want to find out what our panellists think of this. Ruwani, have you had any personal experience of this scheme? Is Max on the money here?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of weeks ago, we explored this on the Hui before we had Minister of Social Development, Carmel Cipollone, on the show. And, you know, I rang some welfare advocates and they were saying that getting support is harder than back in 2020 for beneficiaries. And back then they said that you could receive sort of multiple food grants and that kind of thing. But this lockdown, it's been a lot tougher, much more punitive. And we're talking about whānau and families who are still getting over the impacts of last year's lockdown, you know, still not back to normal in this current environment. There's a definite more punitive, more aggressive, way that they are treated. Now, I get that the wage subsidy, that's obviously protecting jobs and those are really important, but we can't forget about those most vulnerable. I mean, money's never been cheaper. There have been calls to bring those benefit increases from next April forward, but nothing over and above really for these people.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate. I've not had to engage either with the benefit scheme or with the wage subsidy. I've been very, 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 very privileged in that regard. But I'm completely with Max on this. So there seems to be a massive double standard that anybody who's involved in business is obviously upstanding and a good, honest person and deserves a break. And yet we know that beneficiaries, seriously, they're all just money-grubbing, lazy layabouts, aren't they? And they probably deserve to be in prison, quite frankly. And that seems to be the kind of attitude that we're bringing to this. And it's a massive, massive double standard. And one of the things I was hoping that would come out of this pandemic is an understanding that many people who aren't working through no fault of their own. We know people who are getting the wage subsidy, individuals who are receiving it, are receiving it not because they couldn't be bothered to work, but because the pandemic is preventing them. And so we have massive sympathy for them, and we are facilitating in every way possible a way to support them at significantly higher financial levels than we are for beneficiaries. But beneficiaries, as we've just established, obviously don't really deserve it, do they? That seems to be the mentality that we're working with. And I'm going to go with Max and agree that the word repugnance is not too strong.
Max, text here that says, I know of a company on the list of the top 20 claimants who's ripping off the system. I'm afraid of losing my employment if I report them, as it's not anonymous. I think it is, though, that reporting, isn't it?
Sure, a phone call would suffice, wouldn't it? I mean, even the way the media is reporting things, Karen, you know, we even an article just came up this afternoon about, you know, Queenstown businesses going to the wall. The one yesterday, the owner of the 24 cafes around Wellington doing it tough under level two, facing hardship. You know, there needs to be, you know, the way things are phrased as well is just, you know, there needs to be compassion for all during these times, you know.
Yeah, and if I could just briefly add to that, I mean, I think people absolutely can and should, you know, report their employers, and, you know, you can contact the government anonymously. I mean, the one thing I would say in defence of MSD is, you know, after they got rebuked by the Auditor General, they have started doing things like they've written to the, I think, you know, 1,000 of the largest claimants of the wage subsidy, so firms who cover about 1/10 of the total wage subsidy bill, asking them for proof, you know, of eligibility. So that's a positive step. And on the other side, they've actually also, you know, under this government, started taking fewer prosecutions against beneficiaries. You know, they're trying to do more stuff up front, working with people, helping resolve, you know, possible overpayments sort of in a more constructive manner. So none of this is inevitable. You know, it can change depending on what the government, you know, instructs its agencies to do.
Max, Ian, who's read your column, says, hi, Max referred in his column to firms that have made profits and didn't repay the subsidy. Harvey Norman, for example. Disgusting, he says. Cheers, Ian.
Yeah. I mean, it's those companies are possibly acting legally. I mean, they may have had a 30% revenue drop and then, you know, got right back into the black by the end of the year. But I still think it's immoral. I mean, the wage subsidy payment was obviously designed to help firms stave off disaster. It wasn't supposed to go into the coffers of firms who were going to be fine in the long run anyway. And I think one of the things that really bothers me is that we haven't learned the lessons from that. And with this wage subsidy, we haven't inserted a clause that says, if you get the wage subsidy, you have to pay it back to us before you pay your shareholders out.
That still hasn't been done, right? Yeah.
They're not going to particularly care that you've named them. You've named Hellenstein Brothers, Harvey Norman and Fulton Hogan as three companies in your piece. And you said these are large firms taking the wage subsidy, then posting handsome profits and shareholder dividends. So, and anger's been muted, you say, Max.
Yeah, I mean, there has been some anger, you know, and a raft of firms have, you know, been put under public pressure, and they have, to their credit, repaid the wage subsidy, some of them pretty grudgingly. But, you know, there hasn't been a massive sort of tidal wave of anger. We haven't seen pickets outside, you know, the offices of these firms. And I think that comes back to that ingrained sense that, well, maybe they didn't quite do the right thing, but they're the good guys because they're business, you know, in a way that we would never say, oh, well, beneficiaries are the good guys.
Well, Max, thank you for joining us this afternoon and that Articles and Stuff. Thank you. That's Max Rashbrook, who's a senior associate at the Institute for Governance and Policy Studies at Victoria University. It's 14 minutes to 5. And Oranga Tamariki, the Ministry for Children, are in the gun again. A family court judge has ruled that a Māori girl with a very troubled background should stay with her Pākehā foster parents. This girl is 6 and she's been living with this Pākehā family for 3 years, and by all accounts it's a loving and stable environment. But Oranga Tamariki wanted to place her with a Māori family because they thought that this couple couldn't meet her cultural needs. The judge, Peter Kalinikos, he heard applications from Oranga Tamariki and he also the girl's foster parents over 2 hearings earlier this year. And yesterday in his decision he dismissed the ministry's application, and he ruled that the girl will stay with her foster parents in order to avoid disruption and to benefit from their love, stability, care and competence in parenting. But she will spend several weeks a year with her other guardians, including her birth mother, and he wanted Oranga Tamariki to provide support and services to both parties to provide more cultural connectiveness for the child. And just to let you know, if you haven't read this, the judge said it, and his intention wasn't to criticise. It's a very long decision. It's a 145-page decision. But he also made the point that Oranga Tamariki's failure in this case was down to a junior social worker in the agency. And he said, the evidence is overwhelming. Her judgment was influenced by a view that, regardless of all other facts and principles, Māori children must be with Māori caregivers. I'll go to our panellists on this shortly, but in response to this judgment, Ngāti Kahumunu iwi leader Nahiwi Tomoana said that the judge was wrong. He said, the days that judges can tell us we're not good enough anymore are over. This is just another case of other people thinking they know what's best for Māori. Ruwani, should Māori children always be with Māori caregivers?
Well, you know, I've done stories on this very topic, and Oranga Tamariki were looking at changing that. This was years ago now, probably like over 6-7 years ago now. And they do work with Māori advisors and stuff like that in order to find that fit. You know, I think what you know, Ngāti Kahununu are meaning about is the stolen generation, you know, in terms of, you know, totally breaking someone away from their cultural background and heritage. But I think you just need, I think each case is different. And I think this one is one where the judge has made the right decision in terms of, you know, where this child has been for the last 3 years, to uproot them again to an older grandmother that they were going to an older lady that they were going to place this child with, whereas she's getting, you know, it's Maslow's theory of, human need, isn't it? So, you know, your esteem, your love, your belonging, your stability are all really high. And I think more needs to be done with Oranga Tamariki to work with iwi and then their child's, hapu and iwi to connect them culturally, but maintain that love and stability from that whānau that they're getting already, regardless of their skin colour.
Nahiwi te Moana, Stevie said today that if the state was giving Pākehā children to Māori families, there'd be a hell of a hue and cry about it. Would there?
But, you know, quite possibly. Quite possibly there would. There's going to be an awful lot of Pākehā who will be up in arms about that. But I think there's two separate things going on here that we kind of need to tease apart a little bit. On the one hand, there's the broad principle of, it does make sense that Māori children who are part of a tradition and a heritage and a culture and a whakapapa, it makes sense that they would ideally be raised within that tradition and within that context. I mean, you know, that's a beautiful idea, and I would support that in principle. We've then got a separate issue, which is this particular individual, Moana, she's being named as in this context. And so Moana is an individual, and we have to look at those specific circumstances. And I think it says that she's been with Mr. and Mrs. Smith, they're named it, yeah? In this story. And she's 6 years old, and she's been with them for 3 years. So basically all of her sentient life, really, pretty much, she's been with Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So within this particular context, yeah, the time for doing the right thing was 3 years ago. And unfortunately, the very nature of time is that we can't go back and undo that. And it's entirely, there's a very, very strong case to be made that Oranga Tamariki should have placed Moana within her own culture, within her own tradition. That would have been the right time to do that. We can't undo that now, and so we need to look at the situation we find ourselves in, and that's why I'm going to suggest that this is the most impossibly knotty situation, and all I can say is I'm glad I'm not a judge.
Yeah, there's obviously
it is a tough one, but they do, I do believe that they do have to look within the hapu or the iwi first. But, you know, the case that I looked at, no one stepped forward within the family, but still that child was taken from the Pākehā family. And you know, it just causes, you know, even more tumult in these children who are the most vulnerable, who have had, you know, terrible trauma inflicted on their lives. And, more needs to be done in that respect. But,
a big question that the judge asked, and this was central to his judgment, why this young social worker was making such life-altering decisions on her own, it would seem, within Oranga Tamariki.
That's
a great question to ask in hindsight. And clearly there are lessons to be learned, and dare we even say learnings to be had out of this. But what we can't do is use hindsight to try and correct any possible mistake that's been made. Moana has now been placed in a family who clearly are taking care of her. To the best of my knowledge, there's no suggestion that the Smiths are in any way inadequate or failing, other than the fact that they are Pākehā rather than Māori. That's the only downside that's being expressed, as far as I can tell, in this. And we have to look at then, at this point, how much trauma, how much upheaval would it represent to move this child to another home? It's a bit of a wonderful compromise that the judge has come up with. That now, what are they naming them? Mrs. Taipa and Ms. Taipa will be significant part of her upbringing. I think that's an interesting compromise. And again, he's a better man than I am for even taking this one on.
Thanks, Steve. Steve McCabe and Ruwani Pereira, our panellists today. It's now 5:07, and let's talk about a bit of fun. Do we need to relearn how to have fun after about a year and a half of sadness and sickness and stress that's been caused by the pandemic? Yale psychology professor Laurie Santos says it's more important than ever to make sure that we're including fun activities in our lives. But really, what does that mean? According to this professor, less binge-watching TV and more of the following. There's a list here. Sing-along sing-alongs to your favourite songs. doing karaoke and trying challenging new activities, surfing or learning to play the guitar. Well, we can't surf on level four, can we? Can we? I don't think we can.
No.
Does web surfing count?
Yes, web surfing. So,
sorted.
I'm doing exactly what he's saying not to do, binge watching television shows.
Are you? So, what have you been watching?
Very good.
Yeah, what can you recommend for us?
White Lotus, of course. I've done that one.
Wasn't that brilliant?
Very, very clever. Have you seen that, Karen?
I haven't. What's it called? White Lotus.
White Lotus.
Oh, White Lotus. White Lotus. I have seen White Lotus. It's brilliant. Yep. And it's so brilliant it's just so perfectly reveals human characteristics, doesn't it? Like, you know, I love the bit in it where the woman who works in the holistic centre, she's hoping that rich woman will give her, pay for her to open a centre.
Oh, that's
it's just
heartbreaking,
isn't it? Oh, heartbreaking. And you think, oh, is this today, you know, during the dinner? No, that's been a standout, definitely. There's lots on. I've got a few. I've added a, Amazon account the other day. I've added a few extra streaming accounts.
Ruwani, can I offer you a recommendation?
Yes, please.
If you've not seen Ted Lasso, get hold of it right now.
Yes.
It is possibly the loveliest show on TV.
Say, Apple, that's a beautiful, feel-good, charming British one. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that. No, I haven't seen that yet. What's it called?
Ted Lasso.
Oh, Ted Lasso. Okay. These are both not very healthy preoccupations, are they? You know, in terms of just...
I haven't done a sing-along, no.
We can't get out much, though.
Ruwani and I are bonding over this here. I say this is very healthy. We're forming a new friendship. This is good.
It's true.
Exactly.
It's good.
There you go.
Sing alongs to your favourite songs. I mean, if you did that kind of deliberately, it would be a bit weird, wouldn't it? I must now do my sing along.
Yes, it's in the calendar for 7 o'clock this evening.
Yes.
I mean, I'm a big karaoke fan, don't get me wrong, but it's just the lockdown thing doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right.
No. Well, speaking of 7 o'clock this evening. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to ask what song. Yeah, what's the song that you do?
Quite a few. You're So Vain's quite a good one just to get started. Mm-hmm. But Bit of Living on a Prayer. There's a few. Jessie's Girl.
Yeah. Well, you could belt out a few for us just before we go to 5 o'clock. Come on.
Well, a little bit early for me.
And Steve, are you going out for walks?
My poor dog, I dragged her along today. Biscuit's about, she's nearly 14 years old. And she's not as lively as she used to be. And I dragged her around the block today, the poor thing. I get the lead out and she starts wagging her tail. But by the time we get halfway up West Street, I think she's going, no, seriously? Can we go home now, please? I need it for my sanity. I am going to recommend one thing for tonight, by the way. One thing that my family and I did last week and we're going to do it again tonight. The pandemic pub quiz. I don't know if any of you guys know about this.
No.
The organisers, whose name I forget and they'll never forgive me for it, were featured on RNZ last week, and that's how I found out about it. And it's an online Zoom-based pub quiz.
Lovely.
And I'm very pleased
New
to
Zealand's
say that my family...
New Zealand's largest virtual pub quiz. Fantastic. I love me a quiz.
Yeah, what's your specialist subject, Steve? What are you good at?
Not sports.
What are you good at then?
Same.
Yeah.
Everything
actually,
else.
Oddly enough, last week the round that we excelled at was the food and drink round.
Oh yeah, like what?
Oh God, I can't even remember the questions now. I mean, that's a week ago. It's a whole week ago. That's 17 years in non-lockdown time. Come on.
Well,
Steve, I'm very particular about my pub quizzes. Are they good general questions? General knowledge questions?
I think they're very good. I mean, one question that came up last week that I thought was a great sort of question to tax people. What's the second highest mountain in New Zealand? It's very well done. It's about an hour and a half long. It's 60 questions. It costs $30 per team to join, but I strongly recommend it.
Oh, my gosh. What is it? What is the second highest mountain in New Zealand?
I just said a week ago. You expect me to remember anything?
Taranaki? That's us. We've got to go. My thanks, Steve McCabe. Thank you so much.
Quick, get out.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, get out before we have to answer that. Ruwani Pereira, thank you.
Thanks.
Great to talk to you both. That's the panel, and have a great weekend, everyone. We'll try to here in Auckland. Lisa Rowan is next with Checkpoint. Good afternoon.